Hello and welcome to episode 103 of the Tech Reformation, where the world of technology meets the worldview of Christianity. I'm Ben.
I'm Craig.
And this is Stank.
This week, we're talking about virtual reality and dementia in Japan, technology as wealth, and church online. Without further ado, let's get started.
This article is pretty interesting. It's about a Japanese company, and they made a VR simulation to simulate having dementia. And first, I wanted to say something about VR. Maybe a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, at some point in my life, within probably a month, I got to experience pretty good VR for the first time. It was the PlayStation VR, and it was a racing simulator. And so there was like one of those arcade type cars. And yeah, they say VR is meant to be immersive. And I tried one and it was really lame VR. And so I was like, I don't know about this. And then I tried this one. It was good VR. And like, you know, whenever you're driving, you can see through the goggles, you can see your hands on the steering wheel. And then headphones were over my ears. And I saw the radio station in the car. And I was like, oh, I wonder if I can change it. So I lifted my hand to actually change the, touch the radio. And then my hand didn't move from the steering wheel in the game because I didn't have any hand controller things. I was like, oh, yeah, right. That doesn't work. And then a little bit later, playing the game, my nose itched. And so I lifted my hand up to scratch my nose. And when the hands again in the game didn't move, it kind of was like a disconnect from my brain. And I put my hand back on the steering wheel real quick. I was like, whoa, oh yeah, those aren't real hands. So yeah, that was my experience with VR actually being immersive. And so that leads me into this topic where they use VR to make you feel like you're a person with dementia. So you're on public transportation, and basically I didn't like watch a YouTube video where they go through it, but they described it. And essentially, like, you realize you're on a train, but you have no idea where you're supposed to get off. You forgot what you're doing. And you can see other people get off and you think, am I supposed to get off here or do I not get off here? Can't remember. And you go to the next stop, you see more people get off. You're like, well, I guess I'll get off. And you get off and then you're like, well, I don't know where I need to go now. And so just that feeling of fear, like, where am I? Who are all these people around me? What am I going to? So the purpose of these simulations, they've made multiple. It says they're aimed at helping viewers expand their imagination so they can empathize with sufferers more and start thinking about how to live with dementia instead of how to prevent it. And so, yeah, the idea is being, we're actually able to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And so it's more than just like an awareness campaign where it's like, hey, people have dementia. Lots of people have dementia, actually. And cool or not cool, you know, like just and you're actually able to put yourself in their shoes and see like what life is like in that, and then be able to move from there. So yeah, so that's what they're doing. Do you guys have any initial reactions on that?
And this is a firm in where?
It's in Tokyo.
What?
I don't understand what's funny. These guys are crazy.
I'll post a video in the Slack. Okay. And we've referenced this, the video that I'll post in the Slack before. So Ben, okay. Remember.
Anyway, Craig, you were saying something meaningful in response to the topic?
Yeah, I was going to, and then we got derailed, which kind of ties back into the train thing that Tank was talking about, and which was what I was going to talk about anyway. I think that's an interesting concept, although I guess the downside is being lost is kind of only one aspect of, or feeling lost is only one aspect of dementia. I'd be interested to know what else is going to go into the software. Like, are they going to give you like hallucinations or like just introduce you to people, like put you in situations where you're like at a family function and everyone's coming up to you and talking to you, but you don't know who they are. And like they're sort of familiar with you, but you have absolutely no idea who these people are and stuff. Like, I wonder in what other ways they'll extend the experience to have more of an impact. Because I think all of us have at some stage felt lost or unsure about directions and things like that. That's just kind of like a normal part of life if you're in a an unusual setting or something, that sort of unsettled feeling of I'm not sure what to do and where to go. But I guess there's other... I sort of went through this thing with my grandpa who died a couple of months ago. He, in the sort of year leading up to when he passed away, there was he had dementia quite severe throughout that time. And just sort of seeing him slowly get worse and trying to, you know, it's kind of hard to interact. It is hard to put yourself in their shoes because you don't know how much of, at what stage they're at and therefore how much they're remembering and all that kind of thing. Like sometimes I visit him and he'd remember who I was and the next time he wouldn't, but then the time after that he would again, but he'd forget other things about me and stuff. So I'd imagine it's unsettling on so many different levels. So it's, I kind of feel like something like this is a great idea to kind of get people's heads around the problem and how to maybe relate to people who suffer from this issue or whatever, this illness. But I wonder, what other sort of things they can plug into it to kind of make it more of a rounded experience of having such a plaguing sort of condition, I guess.
Yeah, honestly, there's actually six... they've done six videos on dementia, so I'm sure there's other scenarios like that. And also, these people, they also run like a dementia help facility. And like it was describing in the article kind of how their attitude is, they want to try to make it just like a normal living place instead of like locking the door. And they said like most dementia places lock the door. And they also have like all these like children like celebration things. And it's like, why do they play kids music? What if they want to listen to the Beatles? You know, it's like there's normal people. And it said they only like go looking for people if they've been lost for like 3 or 4 hours, because sometimes it takes an hour to get to the convenience store that's 5 minutes down the street just because they kind of forget where they're going.
Ooh.
And so they're...
I don't know how I feel about that one.
Yeah. So they, yes, but they're trying, you know, they have a lot of experience with people with dementia, and they said that they got a lot of input from people with dementia making these videos. So yeah, I think they at least went about it the right way.
Yeah,
and I think, I think in the future, it's cool to see VR being used for something more than just entertainment. And even more so than, just like information, like what would it be like to walk on Mars? And so, I think, these people are using VR for a way that is, actually trying to help people. And I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, that was my first thought about it when you brought it up, was this is maybe the coolest use of VR that I'm familiar with to date. And it sort of opens up a world of possibilities that we could just imagine and hopefully build eventually. The effort toward increasing empathy toward one another, and especially on causes and issues and problems that we just don't all know much about or have firsthand experience with. It's really cool. I was just wondering, Tank, having done at least PlayStation VR, and I'm sure there's some differences across the platforms, but just thinking through Craig's thought about how much more immersive could it be into that person's experience with dementia. What are the, I mean, I guess the simplest way to ask, are there like haptic feedback types of things with the headset or the controllers, the things you hold in your hands? Like how can you interact with the device? So like, how does it tell you that you forgot where you are on the train? Is that just audio that's playing, like you're thinking out loud or something? Or how are you experiencing that in the headset? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So within this specific, within this simulation, I don't know. I didn't watch a YouTube video of how they do it. And so the article describes like you wake up on a train and you look around and you don't really know any of these people. And then you're compelled to get off the train.
Oh, okay.
So
gotcha.
It may just be like you're just watching and you're realizing you're thinking these things on your own. I don't know if there's like text that shows up on the screen or anything.
Yeah.
Like that. I have no idea.
I was just curious. Do you know of like the helmet can buzz or something like that? Does that exist today? It seems like that would be a pretty common interaction.
Helmet can buzz?
Like haptic feedback, you know, like on your phone when you, I don't know, simple example. I don't actually have a home button on my new iPhone.
Oh,
but when I push it, it buzzes at me as if I'm pushing a real button. things like that that make it feel real when it's not. That seems like those are the next sort of steps in my mind towards a more immersive experience.
Yeah, the chair in the whenever I was doing the driving thing did. Whenever I ran into the wall, it would shake some. So, but yeah, I don't know about the dementia thing at all.
And I'm sure those things can be more or less realistic, of course. Like the arcade game from 15 years ago is not super immersive because it's not super realistic. But I mean, we've had significant advances in technology since then. So be interesting to try out.
I listened to an episode of Doug Wilson's podcast, which is called The Plodcast. I think it's relatively new. I've been listening a little bit. I can't remember where I heard about it. But yeah, I generally like Doug Wilson, and I think he's got a lot of good things to say. And this episode was of interest to me because in the title it said technology as wealth, and then a bunch of other things he was going to talk about. And I was like, I wonder what he means by that. And sort of he started off by explaining that obviously tech is everywhere, it's ubiquitous, we use it all the time, but Christians are a little bit unsure of how we should be using it, which I guess pricked my ears up even more because then I was like, well, that's exactly what our podcast is about. But then he sort of said, you know, he started talking about the fact that the Bible doesn't speak specifically about some of the things that we've been talking about recently, like smartphones and how much we should use them and how we should use them and that kind of thing. It doesn't mention smartphones. It doesn't mention televisions. It doesn't mention the internet, obviously, because those things weren't around. But he quoted Van Til, who said that the Bible is authoritative in everything it addresses and it addresses everything, meaning that it addresses everything in principle. And so he said, we basically have to be able, like, there must be some way of using biblical principles and applying them to technology in the way that we use it in order to use it in a way that glorifies God and doesn't turn into idolatry, I guess is the flip side of that. And so he said he thinks that probably the best way to do that is to think of technology as wealth, which seems pretty logical to me, because property and possessions are spoken about as being an indicator of wealth in the Bible. You know, when it talks about landowners and people like that who own lots of stuff or they have lots of livestock or something, it's usually a sign that they're sort of powerful and whatever. So wealth is a good thing that God can give to people, and we should be grateful for that. But then he says that the temptation is to not be grateful and I guess to instead be prideful or get greedy or something like that. That kind of was initially, I was like, I don't know, is it wealth or is it just like property or possessions? But I think it all comes under the same banner. So I think he's right to kind of draw that distinction. And then he started talking about, like, if you imagine George Washington or someone, you know, 200 or 300 years ago or whatever, even 100 years ago, and you wanted to research something and also find out the best way to get to somewhere and create an image of something, then you needed to go to people who had those skills who could do those things for you or could tell you the information you needed to go and find out somehow. Now you have apps on your phone that can do it in a short amount of time. So he kind of said even that is like, even the apps we have are like having a whole bunch of servants in your pocket that you can just quickly draw on to access what you need, which I thought was kind of cool. So first, I have two questions. The first thing is, what do you guys think of that sort of analogy between wealth and technology? Do you see any holes in that sort of theory or that way of thinking about it? Or do you think it's pretty watertight? And then I have a follow-up question to that.
This is the second time I've heard of thinking of technology as wealth, because the first time was when David McCookie mentioned this in the Slack. And if I recall correctly, it was from Doug Wilson originally as well. So I listened to the podcast as well, and I've been thinking about it, and I can't think of an issue with it. I don't know, and this isn't a solid argument for it, obviously, but I can't think of a better biblical, like something in the Bible that is referred to that technology would fit into, I guess, biblical category. I can't think of another one that fits better. And I can't think of a reason that wealth doesn't fit. So this is something that I'm really glad that you brought this up, Craig. I would love to hear feedback from the listeners, from our listeners in the Slack, especially, or on Twitter. If you have any thoughts on this sort of biblical category of wealth being applied to technology, I generally tend to agree with it because I just can't see trouble with it or think of a better category.
Tank, what do you think?
I'm on the same page, but I haven't thought anything of it until just now. So
that's fair enough.
But as gut reaction, yeah, it makes sense.
And then he sort of, so he went from talking about that to, he then said, obviously, there's a downside of our interactions with technology, which is that, I guess, similar to any other wealth, you know, the Bible talks about the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And we know that money is a good gift, but a bad, what is it? It's a good servant, but a bad master. You know, so we can use it and we can use it well, and we can use it for the glory of God. We can use it in our everyday lives. But when we are mastered by it, and when we are devoted to that above God, then that's hugely problematic. So then his language, just at the end, he sort of subtly slipped in the, you know, I'm sure it wasn't underhanded. He hasn't had the same discussions we have, but he slipped in this sort of language of technology and wealth have a bias, which is to make us, you know, forget about God or not be grateful for what God has given us, and instead to focus on the gift rather than the giver. Which then I was like, is he getting into tech neutrality there? Like, is he, you know, is that what he means by bias? Or does he just mean that it's something that, if used improperly, can become a negative, a force for evil rather than a force for good in our lives, I suppose. I'm not wanting to reopen up the whole tech neutrality discussion.
Well, we couldn't do that if we wanted to, because Derek's not here.
Yes, we could. But what do you guys think about the language of bias? Like, is that a good way to describe sort of the connection that technology has to us? So we've always talked about the fact that we can act on technology to make it do what we want it to do. And there's always been some level of agreement on the fact that technology has something coming the other way, but we've usually sort of rested on there's a balance between how much we do and what it does. Or at least Derek and Ben have fought it out and never really come to one or the other. But is bias like a helpful way to think of it? Like, it's kind of tended it towards a negative, but it can easily be used for good instead.
I mean, he used bias to describe both wealth and technology. And so if we kind of think of it in the wealth concept, you know, the just all of our theology about, you know, having lots of money too is kind of similar in what he's describing. And so I think whenever I think of it in that light, you know, I think at least we as humans, with being sinful people, have a bias to use our wealth in a negative way, to not be giving, to not be grateful for it. And so wealth, lots of money, wealth, can also be used for good, but we have the, humans have the sinful nature where they tend to use, money for evil. And so in the same way, yeah, we at least, maybe the technology not, but we have that bias towards using it for evil. And so, yeah, I think that it may be, instead of saying that stuff has that bias, we could say at least we have that bias to use our technology and wealth.
Totally agree with what Tank just said. That distinction is the one I've been trying to make this whole time with tech neutrality. The bias is not on the part of technology. It's on the part of our sinful hearts. And I think, so one thing Tank brought up, which is really interesting, is, okay, let's say technology is wealth. Well, what does the Bible have to say about lots of money? And we could turn to certain New Testament verses and talk about how the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And so it seems like the accumulation of lots of stuff is maybe not a good thing. But then when we think about it, it's also talked about as being a blessing from God and a very good thing to have lots of stuff and money. And the issue really is our attitude towards the stuff we have. Do we love it more than the one who gives it? Just as Craig pointed out earlier. I feel like this illustration proves the point more than anything else I could say. If I think about the two richest people in the world in all of time in the Old Testament, just think about Adam and Eve. They had everything at one point. And what was their problem? They wanted more. That's the issue. They could have had everything. God said, you can have every tree that you want. Just don't eat of this one. And they wanted the one they were explicitly told not to have. That's our same sinful tendency today.
Yeah. It's the gratitude exchange for greed thing that's the problem, which is a heart problem, not a technology problem.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm still a firm believer in the fact that there aren't inherently good or bad things, just us. We are inherently sinful.
That's true. Total depravity. So we'll finish with this, which Doug referenced in his episode as well, and I think it follows on well from what Ben was just saying. 1 Timothy 6:17 and following says, "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life."
Our sponsor this week is Missional Wear, your Reformed theology gift shop. At this point, you know the shtick. You know Missional Wear has all kinds of t-shirts, hoodies, different apparel, posters, etc., drinkware. However, I am going to talk to you very specifically about a particular set of drinkware they have, their tumblers. They just updated their tumblers with colors. And I don't know about you, but I am all about pastels. And they have pastel colored tumblers and they look amazing. You got to go check them out. You can find that over at missionalware.com. Go to the drinkware section and just scroll down to tumblers and look at them there. Even if you're not into tumblers, they've got a bunch of other things on their website that may appeal to your Reformed sensibilities. So go on over to missionalware.com to get your lifestyle on mission to the glory of God. And if you decide to buy anything, just let them know that we sent you. Thank you, Missional Wear, for sponsoring this week of Tech Reformation.
I have been thinking about the topic of church online since our 100th episode, and thinking back to a joint episode Derek and I did with After the Sermon, which is now no longer on the internet. So I'd like to talk about it briefly here with you guys.
Our episode is right, just not After the Sermons.
After the Sermons is not. That's right. I'd love to talk about it briefly here with you guys. And I guess the question is, can church happen online? I listened to recently a podcast by Moody Radio called Up for Debate on this topic. In October, they had a show on the topic, could church happen online or can church happen online? I'll link that in the show notes if you're interested. I'm pulling in just a few of the stats that they mentioned there, but that really is just inspiring our conversation. So wanted to lead off with this, and they mentioned this in their show. According to a 2015 Barna study, 87% of pastors think it's theologically acceptable to provide religious experiences through the internet. Almost half of pastors think that in the next decade, some people will have all of their faith experiences through the internet. And then finally, 1 in 7 pastors think the internet is more likely to spread heresy than authentic Christianity. So you can see the proportions there of people who are seemingly pro-internet integrated into Christianity, and then people who seemingly are not so much. And it's definitely not a black and white thing. As I think we'll get into, there are quite a few category distinctions that I know we'll want to make. One is that I think is really helpful is delivering content versus pastoring and having relationship. So it's not, I would not say that we're doing church online just because we upload our sermons to a podcast feed or because we have a website and we put our sermons online. I think that's fine. Like my church does that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I would not call that doing church online by any stretch of the imagination. I think generally what people are thinking about is live streaming, typically with a chat room. And even when you can, in a lot of places, and I'm familiar with them firsthand from the past, you can even click the button when the opportunity to respond comes up. And so the idea is you're there. You're just connected via the internet. And so
you do like a sim style altar call where you like walk down an aisle.
You typically don't have a sim, but I don't know, man. Second Life was a thing that was going to happen at one point. So what do you guys think? Can you do church online?
No.
Why not?
Well, yes and no. Well, church is the good thing about the way that you phrased that is, can you do church? It's can you go to church online, like, would be problematic because the church is people, not a building, right? So you can, I think you can be the church. We can be the church online. We can be Jesus' hands and feet, his way of reaching the world. Some of that can quite easily take place online. And in fact, the online world really helps us with that. But in terms of spreading the gospel more quickly and easily and reaching places that we otherwise couldn't reach. But there is, like you were saying, Ben, an inherently relational aspect to church that I think involves a level of knowing people on a level that doesn't typically happen in purely online relationships. So you can pray for people who you've met online, like you guys. I can pray for you guys. I can talk to you guys. I've never met you in person. I've only ever spoken to you online. There's certain things I can do that are things that people in your church would do for you. I cannot cook you a meal if you're on your deathbed. Do you know what I mean? Like I cannot come alongside you and in a time of temptation and be with you in that and walk through that with you or visit you when you're, do you know what I mean? Like there are certain things that I just can't do that, again, the body of Christ should be doing for its members. And so I think there are problems with actually saying the only way I do church is online. I think everyone who is involved in being the church online needs a local body that they're also a part of.
Yeah, you brought up a really important distinction there, Craig. And I could be wrong on this, but from my own past experience and from the people who I hear arguing for church online, what I hear them wanting to say is that the Sunday morning worship gathering is happening online. That's what I think people mean, the vast majority of them at least, mean by doing church online. And so we don't mean being a good Christian on the internet. That definitely is a great thing, and we would be advocates of that, as this entire show has hopefully evidenced. So let me ask you, Tank, can church happen online?
Yeah, I think that was a big clarification for me too, was the church is not a building, but it's also not just a worship service. So it was a good clarification. So that's where I was going to go. So my other thoughts, so I'm trying to think, how deep can you get with a person in a virtual, not virtual reality.
Potentially. I mean, maybe that's coming. Yeah. I don't know.
Which that would be the next step, but how deep can you get with someone in an MMORPG? Because I think like that would be the closest you could get, at least right now, kind of like Second Life, but Final Fantasy 14 would work together. You guys could have an after worship service raid together. so anyway, and I mean, I'm thinking you can get pretty deep. Like you can do a lot of things, just in conversation, you know, and if you want to buy a meal for somebody, you can call a place near their house like Domino's can deliver to them or whatever. And I mean, you can't have that personal, like literal interaction, but you can have all the conversations. And if you need someone beside you in time of sin, you can get on Skype and get on the game, and you're in many ways right there. I mean, you can get really far doing discipleship online, I think. But yeah, I still think in the long run, you're not going to have those powerful interactions. And I think, you know, like how to disciple someone to raise children, the best way is to invite them into your house and watch you raise children. And the only way to do that would be to invite your kids on the game, which is already bad parenting. I'm thinking you can get really far in my view, but, I would still say there's going to be some aspects which are lacking. So I think I would be willing to take it further than maybe you guys, but still say that things are lacking.
Well, that's a great point. And I wonder about our definition of discipleship there, though. Like if discipleship is just my relationship with one other person and it's mostly information transfer, then yeah, I would tend to agree with you. But I'm convinced that discipleship also includes my whole life. And so that is not just my relationship with one other person that I'm discipling or that's discipling me, but it's also my relationship with my wife and my children, if Lord willing, I ever have any. And that learning through the context of those relationships that I witnessed firsthand as well, I would find it really hard to mimic that kind of thing online. I'm sure y'all are familiar with the stat that in the Gospels, Jesus spends 85% of his ministry with the 12 or the 3, right? It's not with the masses, but it's with those intimate relationships with those few other people that he's chosen. And so if we're going to follow his lead in our discipleship, we would want to do something similar, that we would spend life and truth with each other.
I was thinking like your wife could be online, you know. And so again, you miss some things there. But I was saying you could take that pretty far still, because you can interact with your wife online and see those kind of interactions. But I still agree, like, even though I'm saying you could take it further, if you really wanted to try to push those barriers, you'd have to be super intentional. But all of discipleship's intentional. And at the same time, you're going to miss that. You can't get the 100%. So I agree with you.
Yeah. I feel like for the reasons you're bringing up, it's a great supplement to what we're already doing. I mean, the internet's awesome in our existing discipleship, but it's not going to do well as supplanting it entirely, it seems like. Let me also just bring up the most common, probably the three most common or popular things I've heard in arguing for church online, like we're talking about. And I'd love to have you respond to these, Craig. First off, this idea of being digital missionaries. So a missionary being someone who carries the gospel across cultural or geographical or linguistic barriers. And so maybe we need digital missionaries across carrying the gospel across the internet. The second being, well, technology is always advancing, and it seems like there are a lot of people in the church who want to reject new advances in technology. Like, think of radio, for example. Christian radio, or putting our sermons out on radio, was not looked favorably upon back when it first came out, but now everyone's doing it. And then finally, basically, and I think this one is the most common, we want to reach as many people as we possibly can, and we need to stay relevant. And so in order to get to as many folks and speak their language, meet them where they're at, we're going to host our services live online as well, so that they can join in from right where they are. Do you have any responses to those, Craig?
Yeah, I think one and three, there's a clear connection there. And I think the heart of one needs to be the heart of three. So number one was digital missionaries, and number three was staying relevant and reaching more people. I think it's fine to live stream. Like, I've got a friend at the moment who's pastoring, I think it's his first church he's pastored out of seminary, and they're streaming their services every Sunday. I think that's great. I have no problem with that. I believe his heart in doing that would be, and I don't want to speak for him, but I think his heart in doing that would be to, you know, to reach more people by providing content, by providing a platform where they can easily hear, not so much staying relevant in terms of like meeting some sort of cultural standard that will only sort of take church seriously if it's live streamed. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think as long as the heart behind it is spreading the gospel, not being cool enough, or do you know what I mean, or hip enough, or up to date enough to be listened to, I think that's kind of the distinction I'd make there. But I think that sort of digital missionaries spreading the gospel using technology is certainly valid, and I don't see any issues with that. What was your question about the advances thing? I didn't really understand the problem with that.
Yeah, I don't either. That's why I asked it. But one other thing on the digital missionaries thing, I'm all for, just like you said, if we want to spread God's truth and especially the gospel, that people can be reconciled to God through Jesus Christ, that's fantastic. And especially if we want to do that using the internet, I'm all for it. I wonder about our definition of missionary a little bit, but I think the undergirding assumption in bringing digital missionaries into the church online conversation is that the worship service, the Sunday morning gathering, is intentionally evangelistic, or maybe intentionally is not strong enough, is primarily evangelistic. And I want to say, I'm not sure that's right. I think it's great if it's evangelistic, and we absolutely should be sharing the gospel. And if people who are not Christians happen into our worship services on Sunday mornings, they need to hear the gospel. That's the best place for them to be. But I think it's more incidental that a non-Christian would show up than it is intentional. Our evangelism is going to happen in relationship as we go out to the highways and hedges to preach the gospel to the lost, right? It's great if your worship service is evangelistic in some form or function, but the main point there is to feed the sheep, as Christ said.
I agree. And I wouldn't call, for that reason, I wouldn't call myself a digital missionary, even though I have a blog and I try and be a good Christian online and spread the gospel wherever I can. I actually think there's a real importance to what Tank's doing, which is someone who feels called as a missionary to go and immerse themselves in the culture, learn the language, become part of the people group, and actually get to know people on a personal level. I think that's vitally important in being an actual real missionary. So the rest of us are kind of fake missionaries who are actually just Christians trying to do what we can to spread the good news, which is what we've been told to do. People who are called by God to be sent missionaries to other nations or other people groups, I think they should be doing what Tank's doing. Tank's doing the right thing in actually being part of the culture, getting to know the people on a face-to-face level.
Yeah, I'm glad you expanded on what I was alluding to more fully. I'd love to preserve the traditional definition of missions and missionaries. I'm totally with you in that, Craig. And Tank, would you like to speak to what a missionary is? Or if that's important?
Yeah. Yeah, I think all that's important. I still go back to the MMO thing. Like, I think, like, again, I know just like posting sermons online and just having a blog, like, that's good and powerful and useful. But like, yeah, online true relationships can be built, especially in something that's like that. And I think there is, there could be power to people getting involved in those kind of games, and spending a lot of time in there and building relationships and trying to reach people that way. Because I know for myself, the person I was before I was a Christian, I was afraid of people. I wasn't able to talk to anybody, but whenever I got inside of a video game, I turned more into an outgoing, it could express who I was, would talk to people, was building relationships. And so that's where I was turning to for all of my relationships, was an online game. And so I think if someone wants to be a digital missionary, then there are, I think there could be ways that could be explored by using online games to actually be trying to reach people.
There might be people groups that are only reached that way. Is that what you're saying? Like there might be guys, people like who are in a similar situation to what you were, and that is the way to reach them.
Yeah, I think that would be a powerful way to reach them. I wouldn't say that all churches should start throwing their strategies into that, but I think if there's a small group who's really passionate about that, then like that small group could be, working together, and doing life, real life together. But also if they have like, they make a clan on a video game, you know, and that could be one of their main outreach methods together as a community, is reaching out to a community online. And at least personally, I think that there's a lot of real potential value. I haven't really seen it done, but I think there's real potential value in that. And then the last thing I want to say is just that part about being relevant. Again, the definition there of like, we want to be relevant seems to be, we want as many people watching Christian things as possible. And it's not like we want people coming to have a deep relationship with the Lord and his bride, the church. And so like, it doesn't matter whether we're relevant or not. If that part's not happening, the part with the knowing and loving and glorifying God as well as being a part of his body. And so, yeah, I just wanted to tack that on to the relevant part.
Yep. Could not agree more, brother. I just to summarize this, can church happen online question? I think if we're talking about the worship gathering, the answer is clearly no. And I think the reason is that the church is not a place that we go, but a people who gather. And when that group of people gathers, they gather to worship the Lord. And one of the primary ways that they do that is through the ordinances that Christ commanded, that people who repent of sins and believe in Jesus Christ for the first time would be baptized just as he was, and that then as a group they would gather to take the Lord's Supper, the elements of bread and wine, so that not only would they be united together more and more by the divine work of the Lord through that ordinance, but also they would proclaim the death of Christ until he comes again. And I just don't think those things can happen online. The other thing is that just finally, in Hebrews 10, we're told that we should look for ways to encourage one another, not neglecting to meet together. And so I'm convinced that at least where we're at right now, and I don't see how it would be possible in the future today, but at least where we're at right now, you can't do church online. If you would like to connect with us, you can do so by jumping in our Slack workspace. Sign up at slack.techreformation.com.
You can also check out our website. Just drop the Slack from the thing that Ben said and go to techreformation.com, and then you'll get all of the episodes and check it out.
You can also contact us on Twitter @techreformation.
This has been Tech Reformation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
I would say, you know, where two or more of us are gathered. So, like, right now, we're kind of gathered. And so, aren't we a church?
No, it doesn't say where two or more are gathered. That's the church. It says God is with us if we're...
Well, if God is with us, aren't we the church? I'm just kidding. That was in our training, someone said, don't ever say that. It's like whenever you get with one or two other people, you didn't start a church.
Yeah, that's right.